Bill Dawe worked through the long, heavy afternoon at the head of a trail of binders and stackers, until there was a shout and the men ran towards the hedge. Iago Peedbury's big field was right on the other side. His farmhands were wheeling the combination harvester through the gate. Bill joined the others leaning over the hedge. The distant figure of Simnel could be seen, giving instructions. A frightened horse was backed into the shafts. The blacksmith climbed up into the little metal seat in the middle of the machinery and took up the reins. The horse walked forward. The sparge arms unfolded. The canvas sheets started to revolve, and probably the riffling screw was turning, but that didn't matter because something somewhere went clonk, and everything stopped. From the crowd at the hedge, there were shouts of, "Get out and milk it!" "We had one, but the end fell off." "Tuppence more and up goes the donkey!" And other time-honoured witticisms. Simnel got down, held a whispered conversation with Peedbury and his men, and then disappeared into the machinery for a moment.
"It'll never fly. Veal will be cheap tomorrow."
This time the combination harvester got several feet before one of the rotating sheets split and folded up. By now some of the older men at the hedge were doubled up with laughter.
"Any old iron, sixpence a load." "That's the other one. This one's broke."
Simnel got down again. Distant catcalls drifted towards him as he untied the sheet and replaced it with a new one. He ignored them. Without moving his gaze from the scene in the opposite field, Bill Dawe pulled a sharpening stone out of his pocket and began to hone his scythe slowly and deliberately. Apart from the distant clink of the blacksmith's tools, the ship-ship of stone on metal was the only sound in the heavy air. Simnel climbed back into the harvester and nodded to the man leading the horse.
"Here we go again. Any more for the skylark? Put a sock in it."
The cries trailed off. Half a dozen pairs of eyes followed the combination harvester up the field, stared while it was turned around on the headland, watched it come back again. It clicked past, reciprocating and oscillating. At the bottom of the field, it turned around neatly. It whirred by again. After a while, one of the watchers said gloomily,
"It'll never catch on, you mark my words."
"Right enough. Who's going to want a gadget like that?"
said another.
"Sure, and it's only like a big clock. Can't do anything more than go up and down a field."
"Very fast."
"Cutting the corn like that and stripping the grain off."
"It's done 3 rows already."
"Bugger me."
"You can't hardly see the bits move. What do you think of that, Bill?" "Bill?"
They looked around. He was halfway up his second row, but accelerating. Miss Flitworth opened the door a fraction.
"Yes?"
she said suspiciously.
"It's Bill Dawe, Miss Flitworth. We brought him home."
She opened the door wider.
"What happened to him?"
The two men shuffled in awkwardly, trying to support a figure a foot taller than they were. It raised its head and squinted muzzily at Miss Flitworth.
"Don't know what came over him,"
said Duke Bottomley.
"He's a devil for working," said William Spigot. "You're getting your money's worth out of him all right, Miss Flitworth."
"It'll be the first time, then, in these parts,"
she said sourly.
"Up and down the field like a madman, trying to be better than that contraption of Ned Simnel's. Took 4 of us to do the binding. He nearly beat it, too.
Put him down on the sofa." "We told him he was doing too much in all that, son."
Duke craned his neck to see around the kitchen, just in case jewels and treasure were hanging out of the dresser drawers. Miss Flitworth eclipsed his view.
"I'm sure you did, thank you. Now I expect you'll be wanting to be off home."
"If there's anything we can do..."
"I know where you live, and you ain't paid no rent there for 5 years, too. Goodbye, Mr. Spigot."
She ushered them to the door and shut it in their faces. Then she turned around.
"What the hell have you been doing, Mr. So-called Bill Dawe?"
"I am tired, and it won't stop."
Bill Dawe clutched at his skull.
"Also, Spigot gave me a humorous apple juice fermented drink because of the heat, and now I feel ill."
"I ain't surprised he makes it up in the woods. Apples isn't the half of it."
"I have never felt ill before, or tired."
"It's all part of being alive."
"How do humans stand it?"
"Well, fermented apple juice can help."
Bill Dawe sat staring gloomily at the floor.
"But we finished the field," he said, with a hint of triumph. "All stacked in stooks. Or possibly the other way round." He clutched at his skull again. "Ugh!" Miss Flitworth disappeared into the scullery. There was the creaking of a pump. She returned with a damp flannel and a glass of water. "There's a newt in it."
"Shows it's fresh,"
said Miss Flitworth, fishing the amphibian out and releasing it on the flagstones where it scuttled away into a crack. People have believed for hundreds of years that newts in a well mean that the water's fresh and drinkable, and in all that time never asked themselves whether the newts got out to go to the lavatory.
Bildor tried to stand up. "Now I almost know why some people wish to die," he said. "I had heard of pain and misery, but I had not hitherto fully understood what they meant."
Miss Flitworth peered through the dusty window. The clouds that had been piling up all afternoon towered over the hills, grey with a menacing hint of yellow. The heat pressed down like a vice.
"There's a big storm coming."
"Will it spoil my harvest?"
"No, it'll dry out after."
"How is the child?"
Bildor unfolded his palm. Miss Flitworth raised her eyebrows. The golden glass was there, the top bulb almost empty, but it shimmered in and out of vision.
"How come you've got it? It's upstairs she was holding it like," she floundered. "Like someone holds something very tightly."
"She still is. But it is also here. Or anywhere. It is only a metaphor, after all. What she's holding looks real enough. Just because something is a metaphor doesn't mean it can't be real."
Miss Flitworth was aware of a faint echo in the voice, as though the words were being spoken by two people almost, but not quite in sync.
"How long have you got?"
"A matter of hours."
"And the scythe?"
"I gave the blacksmith strict instructions."
She frowned.
"I'm not saying young Simnel's a bad lad, but are you sure he'll do it? It's asking a lot of a man like him to destroy something like that."
"I had no choice. The little furnace here isn't good enough."
"It's a wicked sharp scythe."
"I fear it may not be sharp enough."
"And no one has ever tried this on you?"
"There is a saying, you can't take it with you."
"Yes."
"How many people have seriously believed it?"
"I remember reading once," said Miss Flitworth, "about these heathen kings in the desert somewhere who build huge pyramids and put all sorts of stuff in them, even boats, even girls in transparent trousers and a couple of saucepan lids. You can't tell me that's right."
"I've never been very sure about what is right," said Bildor. "I am not sure there is such a thing as right or wrong. Just places to stand."
"No, right's right and wrong's wrong," said Miss Flitworth. "I was brought up to tell the difference."
"By a contrabandistor."
"A what?"
"A mover of contraband."
"There's nothing wrong with smuggling."
"I merely point out that some people think otherwise."
"They don't count."
"But..."
Lightning struck, somewhere on the hill. The thunderclap rocked the house. A few bricks from the chimney rattled into the grate. Then the windows shook to a fierce pounding. Bildor strode across the room and threw open the door. Hailstones the size of hen's eggs bounced off the doorstep and into the kitchen.
"Oh, drama."
"Oh, hell."
Miss Flitworth ducked under his arm.
"And where's the wind come from?"
"The sky,"
said Bildor, surprised at the sudden excitement.
"Come on."
She whirled back into the kitchen and scrabbled on the dresser for a candle lantern and some matches.
"But you said it would dry."
"In a normal storm, yes. In this lot, it's going to be ruined. We'll find spread all over the hill in the morning."
She fumbled the candle alight and ran back again. Bildor looked out into the storm. Straws whirred past, tumbling on the gale.
"Ruined? My harvest?"
He straightened up.
"Bugger that."
The hail rumbled on the roof of the smithy. Ned Simnel pumped the furnace bellows until the heat of the coals was white with the merest hint of yellow. It had been a good day. The combination harvester had worked better than he'd dared to hope. Old Peedbury had insisted on keeping it to do another field tomorrow, so it had been left out with a tarpaulin over it, securely tied down. Tomorrow he could teach some of the men to use it, and start work on a new, improved model. Success was assured. The future definitely lay ahead. Then there was the matter of the scythe. He went to the wall where it had been hung. Bit of a mystery, that. Here was the most superb instrument of its kind he'd ever seen. You couldn't even blunt it. Its sharpness extended well beyond its actual edge, and yet he was supposed to destroy it. Where was the sense in that? Ned Simnel was a great believer in sense, of a certain specialized kind. Maybe Bill Dawe just wanted to be rid of it, and that was understandable, because even now when it hung innocuously enough from the wall, it seemed to radiate sharpness. There was a faint violet corona around the blade, caused by the drafts in the room driving luckless air molecules to their severed death. Ned Simnel picked it up with great care. Weird fellow, Bill Dawe. He'd said he wanted to be sure it was absolutely dead, as if you could kill a thing. Anyway, how could anyone destroy it? Oh, the handle would burn and the metal would calcine, and if he worked hard enough, eventually there'd be nothing more than a little heap of dust and ashes. That was what the customer wanted. On the other hand, presumably, you could destroy it by just taking the blade off the handle. After all, it wouldn't be a scythe if you did that. It'd just be, well, bits. Certainly you could make a scythe out of them, but you could probably do that with the dust and ashes if you knew how to do it. Ned Simnel was quite pleased with this line of argument, and after all, Bill Dawe hadn't even asked for proof that the thing had been killed. He took sight carefully and then used the scythe to chop the end off the anvil. Uncanny. Total sharpness. He gave in. It was unfair. You couldn't ask someone like him to destroy something like this. It was a work of art. It was better than that. It was a work of craft. He walked across the room to a stack of timber and thrust the scythe well out of the way behind the heap. There was a brief, punctured squeak. Anyway, it would be all right. He'd give Bill his farthing back in the morning. The death of rats materialized behind the heap in the forge and trudged to the sad little heap of fur that had been a rat that got in the way of the scythe. Its ghost was standing beside it, looking apprehensive. It didn't seem very pleased to see him.
Squeak, squeak.
Squeak, the Death of Rats explained.
Squeak.
Squeak, the Death of Rats confirmed.
Preen whiskers, twitch nose.
The Death of Rats shook its head. Squeak. The rat was crestfallen. The Death of Rats laid a bony but not entirely unkind paw on its shoulder. Squeak. The rat nodded sadly. It had been a good life in the forge. Ned's housekeeping was almost non-existent, and he was probably the world champion absent-minded leaver of unfinished sandwiches. It shrugged and trooped after the small robed figure. It wasn't as if it had any choice. People were streaming through the streets. Most of them were chasing trolleys. Most of the trolleys were full of whatever people had found a trolley useful to carry. Firewood, children, shopping. And they were no longer dodging, but moving blindly, all in the same direction. You could stop a trolley by turning it over when its wheels spun madly and uselessly. The wizards saw a number of enthusiastic individuals trying to smash them, but the trolleys were practically indestructible. They bent but didn't break, and if they had even one wheel left, they'd make a valiant attempt to keep going. "Look at that one," said the Arch-Chancellor. "It's got my laundry in it, my actual laundry. Darn that for a lark!" He pushed his way through the crowds and rammed his staff into the trolley's wheels, toppling it over. "We can't get a clear shot at anything with all these civilians around," complained the Dean. "There's hundreds of trolleys," said the lecturer in recent rooms. "It's just like vermin. Get away from me, you basket!" "Vermin are small black and white rodents found in the Ramtop Mountains. They are ancestors of the lemming, which, as is well known, throws itself over cliffs and drowns in lakes on a regular basis." Vermin used to do that too. The point is, though, that dead animals don't breed, and over the millennia more and more vermin were descendants of those vermin who, when faced with a cliff edge, squeaked the rodent equivalent of blow that for a game of soldiers. Vermin now abseil down cliffs and build small boats to cross lakes. When their rush leads them to the seashore, they sit around avoiding one another's gaze for a while and then leave early to get home before the rush. He flailed at an importunate trolley with his staff. The tide of wheeled baskets was flowing out of the city. The struggling humans gradually dropped out or fell under the wobbling wheels. Only the wizards stayed in the flowing tide, shouting at one another and attacking the silvery swarm with their staves. It wasn't that magic didn't work. It worked quite well. A good zap could turn a trolley into 1,000 little intricate wire puzzles. But what good did that do? A moment later, two others would trundle over their stricken sibling. Around the Dean, trolleys were being splashed into metal droplets.
"He's really getting the hang of it, isn't he?"
said the senior wrangler, as he and the bursar levered yet another basket onto its back.
"He's certainly saying yo a lot," said the bursar.
The Dean himself didn't know when he'd been happier. For 60 years he'd been obeying all the self-regulating rules of wizardry, and suddenly he was having the time of his life. He'd never realised that deep down inside, what he really wanted to do was make things go splat. Fire leapt from the tip of his staff. Handles and bits of wire and pathetically spinning wheels tinkled down around him. And what made it even better was that there was no end to the targets. A second wave of trolleys, crammed into a tighter space, was trying to advance over the tops of those still in actual contact with the ground. It wasn't working, but they were trying anyway. And trying desperately, because a third wave was already crunching and smashing its way over the top of them. Except that you couldn't use the word trying. It suggested some sort of conscious effort, some sort of possibility that there might also be a state of not trying. Something about the relentless movement, the way they crushed one another in their surge, suggested that the wire baskets had as much choice in the matter as water has about flowing downhill.
"Yo!" shouted the Dean. Raw magic smacked into the grinding tangle of metal. It rained wheels. "Eat hot thaumaturgy, you..." the Dean began. "Don't swear! Don't swear!" shouted Ridcully above the noise. He tried to swat a silly bugger that was orbiting his hat. "There's no telling what it might turn into." "Bother!" screamed the Dean.
"It's no good. We might as well be trying to hold back the sea," said the senior wrangler. "I vote we head back to the university and pick up some really tough spells."
"Good idea," said Ridcully. He looked up at the advancing wall of twisted wire. "Any idea how?" he said. "Yo, scallywags," said the Dean. He aimed his staff again. It made a sad little noise that, if it was written down, could only be spelled puffed.
A feeble spark fell off the end and onto the cobbles. Windle Poons slammed another book shut. The librarian winced.
"Nothing. Volcanoes, tidal waves, wrath of gods, meddling wizards. I don't want to know how other cities have been killed. I want to know how they ended."
The librarian stacked another pile of books on the reading desk. Another plus about being dead, Windle was finding, was an ability with languages. He could see the sense in the words without knowing the actual meaning. Being dead wasn't like falling asleep after all. It was like waking up. He glanced across the library to where Lupine was having his paw bandaged.
"Librarian," he said softly.
"Ooh?
You've changed species in your time. What would you do if for the sake of argument, you found a couple of people who... well, suppose there was a wolf that changed into a wolf man at the full moon, and a woman that changed into a wolf woman at the full moon. You know, approaching the same shape, but from opposite directions. And they'd met. What do you tell them? Do you let them sort it out for themselves?"
"Ooh," said the librarian, instantly.
"It's tempting."
"Ooh, ooh."
"Mrs. Cake wouldn't like it, though."
"Ooh, ooh."
"You're right. You could have put it a little less coarsely, but you're right. Everyone has to sort things out for themselves."
He sighed and turned the page. His eyes widened.
"The City of Khan Lee," he said. "Ever heard of it? What's this book? Stripfettel's Believe It or Not Grimoire. Says here, 'Little carts, none knew from where they came. Of such great use, men were employed to herd them and bring them into the city. Of a sudden, like unto a rush of creatures, men followed them, and behold, there was a new city outside the walls, a city as of merchants' booths wherein the carts ran.'"
He turned the page.
"It seems to say..."
"I still haven't understood it properly," he told himself. "One man Bucket thinks we're talking about the breeding of cities, but that doesn't feel right. A city is alive. Supposing you were a great slow giant, like a counting pine, and looked down at a city. You'd see buildings grow. You'd see attackers driven off. You'd see fires put out. You'd see the city was alive, but you wouldn't see people because they'd move too fast. The life of a city, the thing that drives it, isn't some sort of mysterious force. The life of a city is people. He turned the pages absently, not really looking. So we have the cities, big sedentary creatures, growing from one spot and hardly moving at all for thousands of years. They breed by sending out people to colonize new land. They themselves just lie there. They're alive, but only in the same way that a jellyfish is alive. Or a fairly bright vegetable. After all, we call Ankh-Morpork the big wahoony. And where you get big, slow, living things, you get small, fast things that eat them. Windle Poons felt the brain cells firing. Connections were made. Thought gushed along new channels. Had he ever really thought properly when he was alive? He doubted it. He'd just been a lot of complicated reactions attached to a lot of nerve endings, with everything from idle rumination about the next meal to random distracting memories getting between him and real thought. It had grow inside the city, where it's warm and protected, and then it had break out, outside the city, and build something, not a real city, a false city, that puts the people, the life, out of the host. The word we're looking for here is predator. The Dean stared at his staff in disbelief. He gave it a shake and aimed it again. This time, the sound would be spelt pfwt. He looked up. A curling wave of trolleys, roof top high, was poised to fall on him. Oh, shucks, he said, and folded his arms over his head. Someone grabbed the back of his robe and pulled him away as the trolleys crashed down. Come on, said Ridcully. If we run, we can keep ahead of them. I'm out of magic. I'm out of magic, moaned the Dean. You'll be out of a lot more if you don't hurry, said the Arch-Chancellor. Trying to keep together, bumping into one another, the wizard staggered ahead of the trolleys. Streams of them were surging out of the city and across the fields. Know what this reminds me of? Said Ridcully as they fought their way through. Do tell, muttered the senior wrangler. Salmon Run, said the Arch-Chancellor. What? Not in the Ankh, of course, said Ridcully. I don't reckon a salmon could get upstream in our river. Unless it walked, said the senior wrangler. But I've seen 'em thick as milk in some rivers, said Ridcully. Fighting to get ahead, the whole river just a mass of silver. Fine, fine, said the senior wrangler. What do they do that for? Well, it's all to do with breeding. Disgusting. And to think we have to drink water, said the senior wrangler. Right. We're in the open now. This is where we outflank 'em, said Ridcully. We'll just aim for a clear space and...
I don't think so, said the lecturer in recent runes.
Every direction was filled with an advancing, grinding, fighting wall of trolleys.
They're coming to get us! They're coming to get us! Wailed the bursar.
The Dean snatched his staff.
Hey, that's mine!
The Dean pushed him away and blew off the wheels of a leading trolley.
That's my staff!
The wizards stood back to back in a narrowing ring of metal.
They're not right for this city, said the lecturer in recent runes.
I know what you mean, said Ridcully.
Alien.
I suppose no one's got a flying spell on them today,
the senior wrangler inquired. The Dean took aim again and melted a basket.
That's my staff you're using, you know.
Shut up, bursar, said the Arch-Chancellor. And, Dean, you're getting nowhere picking them off one by one like that. Okay, lads, we want to do them all as much damage as possible. Remember, wild, uncontrolled bursts. The trolleys advanced.
Ow! Ow!
Miss Flitworth staggered through the wet, rattling gloom. Hailstones crunched underfoot. Thunder cannonaded around the sky.
They sting, don't they? She said.
They echo.
Bildor fielded a stook as it was blown past, and stacked it with the others. Miss Flitworth scuttled past him, bent double under a load of corn. The ability of skinny old ladies to carry huge loads is phenomenal. Studies have shown that an ant can carry 100 times its own weight, but there is no known limit to the lifting power of the average tiny 80-year-old Spanish peasant grandmother. The two of them worked steadily, criss-crossing the field in the teeth of the storm, to snatch up the harvest before the wind and hail stole it away. Lightning flickered around the sky. It wasn't a normal storm. It was war.
"It's going to pour with rain in a minute,"
screamed Miss Flitworth above the noise.
"We'll never get it down to the barn. Go and fetch a tarpaulin or something. That'll do for tonight."
Bildor nodded and ran through the squelching darkness towards the farm buildings. Lightning was striking so many times around the fields that the air itself was sizzling and a corona danced along the top of the hedge. And there was Death. He saw it looming ahead of him, a crouched, skeletal shape, poised to spring, its robe flapping and rattling behind it in the wind. Tightness gripped him, trying to force him to run while at the same time rooting him to the spot. It invaded his mind and froze there, blocking all thought save for the innermost tiny voice which said quite calmly, "So this is terror." Then Death vanished as the lightning glow faded, reappeared as a fresh arc was struck on the next hill. Then the quiet internal voice added, "But why doesn't it move?" Bildor let himself inch forward slightly. There was no response from the hunched thing. Then it dawned on him that the thing on the other side of the hedge was only a robed assemblage of rigs and femurs and vertebrae, if viewed from one point of view, but if looked at slightly differently, was equally just a complexity of sparging arms and reciprocating levers that had been covered by a tarpaulin, which was now blowing off. The combination harvester was in front of him. Bildor grinned horribly. Un-Bildor thoughts rose up in his mind. He stepped forward. The wall of trolleys surrounded the wizards. The last flare from a staff melted a hole, which was instantly filled up by more trolleys. Ridcully turned to his fellow wizards. They were red in the face, their robes were torn, and several over-enthusiastic shots had resulted in singed beards and burnt hats. "Hasn't anyone got any more spells on them?" he said. They thought feverishly.
"I think I can remember one,"
said the bursar, hesitantly.
"Go on, man. Anything's worth trying at a time like this."
The bursar stretched out a hand. He shut his eyes. He muttered a few syllables under his breath. There was a brief flicker of octarine light, and...
"Oh," said the Arch-Chancellor. "And that's all of it?"
"Erinya's surprising bouquet," said the bursar, bright-eyed and twitching. "I don't know why, but it's one I've always been able to do. Just a knack, I suppose."
Ridcully eyed the huge bunch of flowers now gripped in the bursar's fist. "But not, I venture to point out, entirely useful at this time," he added. The bursar looked at the approaching walls, and his smile faded.
"I suppose not," he said.
"Anyone else got any ideas?" said Ridcully.
There was no reply.
"Nice roses, though," said the Dean.